So here we are, 24 hours later. A lot's happened. Or maybe you feel nothing's happened and a lot has happened. Maybe it feels like you've been here for 3 weeks and not one day. Or maybe it's like you've just arrived. But something has happened just spending this time here together. And I know that the first day of any retreat is challenging. Just to take a little barometer check in the room, how many people were sleepy today? Raise your hand. Look around, a lot of company. How many people were restless? Okay. How about aches in the body? All right. And busy mind? That's a pretty safe one. Okay. You're doing great. Right on schedule. And that's what the first day is about, just settling in, as I said in one of the groups. It's like you're in a detox, and you're detoxing from stimulation. And it takes a while to get in touch with your own energy and your own brightness and for mindfulness to start to get cultivated, but it's worth it. I think it's really worth it. I hope we'll still be friends by the end of the retreat, but it's good. And I really want to respect and acknowledge the work that it takes to be here for this first day and that you're still here. So I wanted to talk tonight. I'll start out by reading one of a favorite passage of mine from a great classic, Dharma classic, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi. Anyone read that book? Oh, wow, it's a good book. This is what he says. In our scriptures, it is said that there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left, at the driver's will, before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as well as the first one does, just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels pain on its body. And the fourth will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn how to run. When we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. And if it's impossible to be the best one, we want to be the second best. That is, I think, the usual understanding of this story and of meditation practice. You may think that when you sit in meditation, you'll find out whether you're one of the best horses or one of the worst ones. Here, however, there is a misunderstanding of practice. If you think the aim of practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you'll have a big problem. This is not right understanding. If you practice in the right way, it does not matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. When you consider the compassion of the Buddha, how do you think the Buddha would feel about the four kinds of horses? He would probably have more compassion for the worst one than the best one. When you are determined to practice meditation with the great mind of a Buddha, you will find that the worst horse is often the most valuable one. In your very imperfections, you will find the basis for your firm, way-seeking mind. Those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of practice, the actual feeling of practice, the marrow of practice. But those who find great difficulties in practicing will find more meaning in it. So I think that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best one. Comforting, isn't it? Unless you happen to be one of those people who can sit in full lotus easily. There's hope for you yet, don't worry. But we have such a strong tendency, let's see,
this.
To judge ourselves, see how we're doing, compare ourselves with others, often on the first day, the thought comes, even if you've been doing this for a long time, why did I think this is a good idea? What am I supposed to be doing? And you're just sure that everybody around is getting it but you. Maybe you've had that or thought similar to that. I wanted to talk tonight specifically about this mind that judges and compares either against others or against some kind of imagined idea of what good meditator is supposed to look like. The Buddha talked about this capacity to judge and compare specifically as one of the great challenges in practice. In Pali, it's called mana, M-A-N-A in English, or translated as the conceit of I am. The conceit of I am. And, let me see this. Where is it? Oh, yeah. Did I get the wrong one? Hang on. I want to read to you. I want to read to you a passage from the Buddha, who says, "One who thinks oneself equal to others, or superior, or inferior, for that very reason disputes. But one who is unmoved under those three conditions, for that person the notion equal, superior, and inferior do not exist. For one who is free from views such as these, there are no ties, you're not bound. For one who is delivered by understanding, there are no follies. But those who grasp after views and philosophical opinions, they wander about in the world annoying people." And who do you think gets most annoyed? It's so amazing how we have this capacity to see how we're doing. And the conceit of I am, it's interesting, I hope you caught that, it's not just conceit, I'm better than. Inferior is also mana, and even equal to is mana, because there's this sense of separation. It's me and everybody out there. And so there's still this sense of believing in this sense of self. And something that you might feel comforted by if you find you have this tendency to compare and judge. It doesn't go away very easily. In the classical model of enlightenment, in the Theravadan tradition anyway, there are four stages of enlightenment. A stream enterer, a once returner, a non-returner, and a fully enlightened being. They're all pretty good places to hang out. The conceit of I am is even there at the third stage of enlightenment. It's one of the last things to go. Not until you're a fully enlightened being does the comparing stop. So one way you can think of it if you find yourself lost in a lot of judgment is, well, I'm no higher than third stage anyway. But it's so insidious and painful when we find ourselves caught in judgment. Let me ask just a little check. How many people noticed the judging mind today? No fully enlightened beings here. And it can happen around anything. in our on the meditation retreat. It can happen in particularly in social situations. You know, there you are, maybe sitting at the table in the dining room. You know. Oh my God, she's eating so mindfully. Who does she think she is, Miss Mindfulness over there? Oh, I dropped my fork, everybody knows. Or in walking meditation, you can, people are walking and there, somebody is going really slowly. Wow, what a yogi, Or who do they think they're trying to impress, And can see somebody walking fast, and you can think, wow, they're just not trying to prove anything. They're just themselves. Or an hour later, don't they get it? Why don't they slow down? The mind can go anywhere. In my earlier days of practice, I loved to go really slowly on a longer retreat. You kind of just get in a groove, and it's fun when you're not really efforting or trying. But I'd be walking and be doing my walking meditation all by myself and just really getting into lifting, moving, placing, and really be enjoying it. Somebody else would come into my space and my noting changed. When I was honest with myself, lifting, moving, looking good, lifting, moving, looking good. Because that was what was going on. Oh, yes, you can see me. It's really humbling. And it happens in our society, in our culture, so many different ways. My country. My religion, my class, my city, my basketball team. My basketball team is the champion, by the way. Just won't be forever, but right now it is. Oh, yes. Look, and we identify with our team or whatever it is, and that's me, that's mine. And it's great to root, I root for my basketball team, but to say, oh, we're better or I'm better is really one, not understanding the law of impermanence, it's gonna change, and also this conceit of I am can be so painful. Even my accomplishments, or of course my body, my appearance, or my mind, or my personality. Oh, they're so witty. I'm just a big bore. Listen to them. They're just cracking one joke after another, and here I am. I can't think of a thing to say. Even we can get attached to our neuroses too. When I was in college and I read a lot of existential philosophy, Camus and Sartre and all, and went through a very depressing period. But I was deep, right? And people who were just kind of happy and smiling, oh, how shallow, I knew I was really deep because I was messed up, right? So you can get into that conceit of I am about anything. And just think, when for you on the retreat, since you've been here, have you noticed it? And how have you worked with that? How have you dealt with it? It can happen even after you're a Dharma teacher and you think, you might have the idea, they don't get caught in that. And it happens to, until you're a fully enlightened being. When I first started teaching, this is back in the 80s, and I'd be teaching at a retreat down in Southern California. Lots of people, 150 people or so at the retreat, and I'd be teaching with the rock stars of Dharma. And Joseph Goldstein, my teacher, he'd give a talk and just blow everyone's mind with his depth and clarity and wisdom. You know, then the next night, Jack Kornfield would come up and weave a spell over everyone, just, Then Sharon Salzberg, another great teacher, writes a lot about loving kindness, would come and people would, tears going down their face, you know. And then I'd have to give the next night's talk, you know. And I knew if I was in the audience, I'd be saying, get that guy off and get Goldstein back on. It was really painful. And I finally, at some point, I went to my other main teacher besides Joseph, a man named Ram Dass, who wrote a book called Be Here Now that changed my life. And he and Joseph had been my two main teachers. And I said to him, this is what's happening. I have to give a talk after these rock stars, and I just, you know, can barely open up my mouth without cringing. And, you know, what should I do? And he said, as he often had wise advice, he said, you know, Joseph Goldstein is already taken. Why don't you just be the best Jamie Barras you can be? I went by Jamie in those days. Why don't you just be the best Jamie Barras you can be? You know, you might find he's good enough. Some of the best advice I'd ever received. It took me a while to kind of get, oh, maybe I have something to share as well. But to really be humbled by how this mind can go anywhere. So this conceit of I am, this judging mind, we compare ourselves to others, we compare ourselves to some unrealistic standards, we compare ourselves to the last retreat. Have you noticed maybe at the very last retreat, often the last sitting on your last retreat was you finally get into this place, wow. That's what gets you back to the next retreat. And you often can forget about what happened on the first few days of that retreat. And somehow the mind has these ideas of what's supposed to happen. And as I said last night, there's no supposed to. You will get exactly the retreat you need if you can use it wisely. Life is giving you what you need. As we took those refuges last night, refuge in the Dharma is seeing life is giving us just what we need in each moment to wake up. But this comparing and judging is rooted deeply in this sense of I'm not enough. I'm not good enough as I am. Or some kind of fear that I'll be found out to be an imposter or a fraud. But this is a great misunderstanding. How could you not be enough? Many years ago, it was in my second three-month retreat. This was in 1979. The Dalai Lama came to visit the center in Massachusetts. He had just come to the States for the first time in September. And he came November, and he came to visit. He heard there was this three-month retreat of sincere practitioners, and he said, "Oh, I'll come and visit." And he just had a question and answer. It's a great way to end a retreat, by the way, to have the Dalai Lama come and do a little Q&A. There was one exchange that really impacted me deeply. This guy raised his hand and he said, "Your Holiness, how do you work with self-hatred?" And the translator gave him the question, and at first he didn't get it. self-hatred. And they went back and forth like three or four times explaining the concept of self-hatred to Dalai Lama until finally he got it. And he looked at this guy and he said, "You're wrong. You're absolutely wrong." Imagine sitting 2.5 months and the Dalai Lama comes and says, "You're wrong." But he said it with tremendous compassion, and he went on to say something like, "What makes you think that everything else is part of this universe, is part of the fabric of this universe, and somehow you're not good enough? You're wrong. See correctly." It's a really powerful moment. There's a teaching in the Christian body of wisdom, spirituality, these teachings called the Course in Miracles. And there's this one line in there that I love. It says, "Believing in your littleness is arrogant because it's preferring your own opinion to God's." I'll say it again. Believing in your littleness is arrogant because it's preferring your own opinion to God's. It's kind of what the Dalai Lama was pointing to. But we still believe our opinions, and they're seen through a filter of not good enough. I just want to mention a little bit on how this works, how this phenomenon comes about, say in Buddhist psychology terms and Abhidhamma terms. We are one way of seeing our nature, this mind-body process, is a list called the five aggregates, or the five skandhas, or khandhas in Pali. This mind-body process, five different aspects of our nature. Form, this body, and the other four have to do with mind. Feeling, not so much emotions, but in the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, vedana. Perception, that recognizes things around us. Mental formations, thoughts and emotions. And consciousness, vijnana, that knows. That's who we are. Form, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness. And that skanda or khanda of perception is where it's easy to fall into this comparing mind, because what it does is it files it all experience in the great hard drive here in your brain and remembers things. And when you see something new, you compare it to something that you've known before. Like, this is a bell. And then you say, "Oh, that's a pretty big bell." Not as big as the one that I know in Spirit Rock. Not quite as big, not nearly as big. But it's bigger than the one that I have at home. And so on. Oh, and here's a person, and they're taller, or they're shorter, or they've got straighter hair, or curlier hair. Not good or bad, but just filing away. And it's a very slippery slope when you add on preferences to better or worse. So that's just how we're wired up. And we believe our assessment as far as better or worse, depending upon I like that, I don't like that. But really, who we are is not dependent on comparison with others. There's never been another you. And let's see, I'll share with you The idea is to see who you really are, not in comparison to anybody else, but to see this perfection of life that's manifested as you. Here's a quote from a great Tibetan teacher, Nyosho Kempo, who says, "Buddha nature, the essence of awakened enlightenment itself, is present in everyone. Its essence is forever pure and flawless. Those who recognize their true nature are enlightened. Those who ignore it or overlook it are deluded. There is no way to enlightenment other than by recognizing this Buddha nature and authentically identifying it within one's own stream of being." That's what we're asked to do, to see who we really are. You want to see who you really are? I'll remind you. This is Chloe Thomas, who was who's in from Melbourne, Australia. She was born 8 weeks premature, and this picture was taken when she hadn't quite come to full 9 months term. But you'll get the idea. Meet Chloe. This is who you really are. I don't know if you can see it in the back. When your mind isn't confused, you come into this world innocent, full of wonder, and if you're fed and you're diapered and you're given a little bit of love, that's your true nature that springs forward. But we can forget, and some of us haven't received as much love as it would have been good, but it's still there. And the idea is to remember and awaken it. This is a passage from Martha Graham, the great choreographer to Agnes DeMille. She says, "There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And since there's only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open." And there's the paradox of celebrating your uniqueness, but not taking ownership. Hey, my pure awareness is better than yours. That doesn't make any sense. My unconditional love is better than yours, or not as good as yours. So it's both seeing the relative level and the ultimate level. Let's see. Here. So I want to offer some tips and ideas about working with this judging mind. It's not the end of the talk. There are some hope and some practices for you. And for those who are noticing, oh, the air conditioning is off. Have you noticed? This is what's happening. Let go. There it is. So, a few different ways to work with this judging mind. First is to have tremendous kindness and forgiveness with that habit, since it's so deep, intrinsic in our being, to practice like what we talked about earlier today, self-compassion, right? Where you're just holding that judging mind, oh, how painful, it's okay. Somehow to bring some tenderness, some forgiveness, some understanding for the habit that you've practiced for so long. I'll share with you a personal story that was really a turning point in my own practice around this. This was on my first longer retreat in 1976, 3-month retreat. It was the first retreat at the center in Massachusetts. And I was really getting into it. And this is one of these slow walking stories. So there I was. It was near the end of the retreat, and I was all by myself, and I just decided, okay, let's see how slow I can go. So I pretended to be the French mime Marcel Marceau, if you're old enough to remember. You know, how does he do that? Moving, and you don't even see him moving. So that was my game, right? Just really crawling. And in the middle of this exercise, somebody comes into the walking room who had just come on to the retreat. In those first 2 years at the center, they tacked on a 2-week retreat at the end of the 3-month retreat. Not a good idea. Both for the people coming in and the people who'd been there. And you can really feel somebody's energy when they're coming from the outside world. So there I was, well, should I stop doing what I'm doing or shall I just carry on? And I decided to carry on, knowing it was going to be very bizarre. And there I was just crawling. And after about 2 minutes, this person who was walking back and forth like this, you know, she bolted out of the walking room in what I was sure was comparing mind. And the thought came to me, wow, I really blew her mind. She must think I am a great yogi. And then I heard the words reverberate in my head. And it was like I fell into this trapdoor of ego and presentation and look at me and aren't I wonderful. It was awful. And I became like this caged tiger, just going back and forth saying, what a phony you are. You're never gonna get out of this mind. You think you're so hot. Right? Just went like that for about 10 minutes. And then the thought came to me, the millions and millions of times I had that kind of a thought, but I just hadn't tracked it. It was below the radar. But it was so clear, I know this thought really well now. And the millions of times I had it in this lifetime, and by then I was starting to think in terms of more than one lifetime, that completely boggled my mind. And in a moment, there was this tremendous compassion that said, you are doing the best you can. You are really giving it your all. And you've been practicing it this other way for a long time. This is going to take a while. And so be really kind and patient with yourself. And my heart just broke open. And it was an experience of kindness and compassion and forgiveness that was really new to me. Wow, you're really trying. It's okay. So this is one thing I really encourage you, that compassion practice. I'll share with you actually my own version of self-compassion that was my main practice for 2 years, okay? Working with the judging mind. So I'm giving you my secret teachings now. Because I saw I had a really big judging mind. maybe even better than yours. And I knew I really had to work with this. So this is what I did. Every time I noticed there was a judgment in the mind, this is what I did. And I invite you to do this with me. Close your eyes. And just imagine you've seen the judgment. Oh, there it is again, judging. And now, take your hand and put it on your cheek. And first, feel the tenderness in your hand. And as you hold or caress your cheek, silently, in the kindest voice, just say to yourself, judging, judging, it's okay, judging. And let yourself feel the tenderness. That's how I recommend, you can open your eyes if you like, how I recommend noticing the judging mind. That was my main practice, both on retreat and off the cushion in daily life. I didn't do this all the time. I did it a lot at the beginning because just touching yourself, there's, as I said, it releases physiologically a tender quality of heart. And when I'd forget, I'd do that again. But what started to happen over time was the voice that was noticing was one of great compassion. And so every time I saw there was a judgment in the mind, oh, it was another opportunity to practice compassion. So if you know Kuan Yin, the embodiment of compassion, let Kuan Yin do the noting, or the kindest being that you know. Get in touch with that energy. And if you did nothing else this whole time you're here than noticing the judgments with kindness, it would be time well spent. So that's one strategy. A second one is seeing through the emptiness, seeing through the solidity of who you think you are to the emptiness that's underneath it. Because as soon as we get into that conceit of I am, how am I doing? We are some solid mass, unchanging, that we're wondering how other people are viewing us. So try this little exercise. Close your eyes. We often think of ourselves as a noun, as some body. Person, place, or thing is a noun. As some person or thing, me. Okay, so as you're thinking of yourself as a noun, some body, for a few moments, shift your perspective and become aware of yourself as a verb, as a field of activity, as a flow of life with circulatory system and nervous system and digestive system and muscular system and thoughts and emotions, all just coming and going and coming and going. And there's no place in there that you can point to that's fixed and unchanging. And it says, that's me. You're a verb. And just relax in that for a few moments. And that's where the solidity starts to dissolve. You are the flow of experience called life. Okay, you can open your eyes if you'd like. And that's something that the meditation practice really points to, because you see, have you seen, how many thoughts have you had today? Can you point to any one of them and say, oh, that's me? Did you invite them? Oh, let's have 60,000 thoughts, okay? They just come on their own. How many different moods have you gone through today? How many different sensations have you had today? They're all this flow of life in this pattern called you. And when you start to see through that solidity, the conceit of I am is seen through. So that's another method. A third, I think I might have mentioned this already about Joseph's suggestion, if you're bothered by your thoughts. Did I say that here? I did, you know, those who weren't here. If you're bothered by your thoughts, just imagine they're coming from the person behind you. You know, you don't have to take ownership of those thoughts. They're just coming out of nowhere. You don't have to believe the ones that say, not good enough. Just like you don't have to believe the ones that say, wow, what an amazing human being. It's just you. So that's a third, to see the emptiness of the thoughts. One more that I want to share with you, which is following up on the loving kindness practice that we did this afternoon. And that is this metta practice for self. It's not easy for many people to really feel a loving connection to ourselves. It's a modern disease. You know, it's interesting, by the way, when the Dalai Lama went through that back and forth, and he said, self-hatred? You know, I sometimes think, well, yeah, if you were told from the time you were 1.5 that you are the embodiment of infinite compassion, you've got some good self-image going. But most of us have to work at seeing who we are and appreciating who we are. So I wanted to share with you a way that I stumbled upon loving kindness for myself that has had a big impact on me. And I offer it to you too. It was during a period of about 6 weeks I decided to do a loving kindness, full-on retreat, metta and compassion and joy and equanimity. And the first week, I was instructed, and I did as I was told, to just practice loving kindness for myself. And so there I was, saying the phrases, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, look at these, you know. And it was okay. It wasn't great, but it was okay. I wasn't giving myself a hard time. Just, okay, I'll just keep on doing it, keep on doing it. And after about 3 days, somebody came to my mind who I knew really loved me. And I thought, this would be so much easier if I could just see myself the way they see me. And then I magically connected the dots and I said, well, why do they love me so much? And that's when I stumbled on this particular way of doing the metta for self. And I'll offer this to you. So go inside and bring to mind someone who you have a really warm, loving connection. And like I said earlier, it can be a pet, it can be a child, it can be some dear friend, it can be someone from your past if nobody comes to mind right now in your life. But just bring them to mind and have them right in front of you. Maybe they're smiling back saying, oh, thanks for picking me. And for a moment, feel that connection, that energy that you share. That's pretty mysterious too, isn't it? That we have this unique bond with each person in our life. But just feel this one. the love that flows between you. And now, imagine that your consciousness can inhabit their reality, and imagine looking through their eyes at their friend and get a sense of why they enjoy you so much. All the different qualities, maybe your playfulness or your kindness or your creativity, or notice all of it. Drink yourself in, as one poet says. And from their vantage point, just see, is this person deserving of kindness and happiness? Maybe get a sense of what they would wish for you. Oh, I hope you see all the goodness inside of you. And hope you see how deserving you are. Okay, and now let your consciousness float back from their vantage point to come right back inside your own body. And from the inside, stay connected to what your friend saw and sees. And just wish yourself well. Either may you or may I see all the goodness inside. Share the love that's inside well. And then when you'd like, you can come back and open your eyes. If you weren't able to connect with that, let it go, no problem. Just know that this is an area to keep on working on. But if you got even a glimpse of what your friend sees, then you can't pretend anymore. You can't pretend anymore that you're not good enough, that you're not worthy of love and happiness. It's interesting. Just suppose you met somebody who really understood you, who liked your sense of humor, who enjoyed your take on things and your taste and the way you went through the world, understood your hopes and your fears. Someone who really, really got you. How would you feel about meeting someone like that? Wouldn't it be great? There's one person that gets every joke that goes through your head. Only one. Unfortunately, they happen to be right inside your own skin. But if you met yourself from the outside, you'd be saying, wow, where have you been all my life? What a neat human being. It's just from our own vantage point that we don't see that. We experience what Albert Einstein called an optical delusion of consciousness. So from our vantage point, we don't see ourselves as everybody else sees. You might be thinking, oh, if they only knew what's inside, they'd think differently. But you're the last one that gets what shines through you, whether you know it or not. So this is another way to really get in touch with metta for self. And when you do, you start seeing there's no comparison. How could someone not be or be more worthy than you? You are this unique expression of life. So working with the judging mind and the conceit of I am, having a kindness, forgiveness, seeing through the emptiness, seeing actually having a sense of humor. We don't have time for that, but being able to laugh at this crazy mind makes a big difference. And just seeing yourself, seeing who you really are. So I'll close with a poem that I love by my favorite poet. Her name is Dana Fals. This is called Awakening Now. She says, "Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons, the beloved being the infinite beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid. My motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening." So let's just sit for a minute, let the words settle. Thank you very much for your attention. So you can go out and enjoy the night air.